All right, let's dive into a condition that I know is going to pop up on the SCE, and that's eosinophilic esophagitis.
It's definitely a hot topic and one that can really trip you up if you're not prepared.
Exactly. And that's why we've got the latest guidelines and research lined up for you today, ready to break it all down.
We'll make sure you're armed with the knowledge you need to tackle those EOE questions with confidence.
So to get us started, can you give us a quick rundown of what EOE actually is?
Well, the first thing to remember is that it's chronic. We're talking about a long-term inflammatory condition, and it specifically targets the esophagus.
Okay, chronic inflammation, got it. But what's driving that inflammation?
That's where those eosinophils come in, the star players, you might say. In this whole process, they infiltrate the esophageal mucosa.
Eosinophils, those white blood cells we typically associate with allergic reactions, right?
Exactly. And that's a key point because EOE is often linked to other atopic conditions like asthma, allergic rhinitis, you know, those sorts of things.
Interesting. So we're already seeing a connection between EOE and that broader allergic picture.
Absolutely. It suggests that there's this underlying immune dysregulation going on, this predisposition, if you will, to developing these kinds of conditions.
Okay, so we're dealing with a chronic immune-mediated inflammatory condition, and those eosinophils are the key culprits. But let's talk numbers. How common is EOE, and who's most likely to get it?
Well, studies in Europe and the UK suggest it affects somewhere between 5 to 10 people per 100,000. So not exactly rare, but not super common either.
Okay, so something gastroenterologists definitely need to be familiar with. What about age and gender? Any patterns there?
Yeah, we typically see it presenting in young adults and children. And there's definitely a male predominance. Something like 70% of cases are in males.
Wow, that's a pretty significant gender difference. Now let's delve into the pathophysiology here. What's actually triggering this whole eosinophilic infiltration in the esophagus?
It's a bit of a mystery, to be honest. We know genetics plays a role, that susceptibility piece. But it seems to be this complex interplay of genes and environmental factors.
Okay, so a combination of nature and nurture. What kind of environmental triggers are we talking about?
Well, exposure to certain food allergens is a big one. You know, things like dairy, wheat, soy, even aeroallergens, stuff in the air, can be triggers for some people.
So it's this multifactorial thing, this combination of genetic susceptibility and then those environmental triggers that set things in motion.
Right. And once those triggers hit, that's when the immune system really kicks into gear and things start to go a bit haywire.
And those Th2 cells we mentioned earlier, they're the ones orchestrating this whole immune response, aren't they?
Exactly. The Th2 pathway is kind of like the conductor of the orchestra in this scenario. They release these cytokines, these chemical messengers that call in the eosinophils and tell them, hey, come on over, we've got a party going on here.
And it's not just a harmless gathering, is it? Those eosinophils are actually causing damage to the esophageal lining.
Oh, absolutely. They release all sorts of nasty stuff, like major basic protein, which is incredibly toxic to the esophageal cells.
So they're like little grenades, basically wreaking havoc on the esophagus.
That's a pretty good analogy. And all that damage leads to inflammation, edema, and eventually the tissue starts to remodel itself.
Remodel itself meaning?
Meaning it doesn't function properly anymore. You get fibrosis, stricture formation, the esophagus loses its ability to move food along smoothly.
And that's ultimately what leads to the symptoms we see in EOE patients.
Speaking of symptoms, how does this whole process actually manifest clinically?
Well, that's where things get interesting because the presentation can vary quite a bit depending on the patient's age.
Okay, let's break it down then. Let's start with adults. What are the classic symptoms of EOE in grownups?
The most common complaint you'll hear is dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, particularly with solid foods. It's like things are getting stuck.
So a feeling of food sticking in the throat or chest? Yeah. Exactly. And sometimes it's not just a feeling. They actually experience food impaction where food gets lodged in the esophagus. That can be pretty scary.
That definitely sounds concerning. Mm-hmm. What other symptoms should we be on the lookout for in adults?
Well, heartburn or chest pain is another common one. But here's the catch. It doesn't respond to those typical proton pump inhibitors, PPIs.
So that's a key red flag then, right? If someone's got heartburn or chest pain that's not budging with PPIs, we should be thinking EOE.
Absolutely. It's a clue that something else might be going on besides just simple GERD. Now, in kids, the presentation can be a bit more subtle.
Okay, so what should we be looking for in our younger patients?
Well, failure to thrive is a big one. They're just not gaining weight as they should. You might also see vomiting, abdominal pain, and often they develop this aversion to food.
Like they're afraid to eat because it causes them discomfort.
Exactly. And that can be really heartbreaking to see, especially in those little ones who can't always articulate what they're feeling.
It sounds like diagnosing EOE in children can be quite a challenge, given those non-specific symptoms.
It definitely requires a high index of suspicion. You have to be thinking about it, especially in kids who aren't thriving and have those feeding issues.
Okay, so we've got a suspicion. We're thinking EOE might be in the mix. What's the next step? How do we confirm the diagnosis?
That's where those diagnostic criteria come in, and this is crucial stuff for the SCE. We need objective evidence to make the call.
So we need more than just a hunch or a gut feeling.
Exactly. And that evidence comes from two main sources, endoscopy and histology. During an endoscopy, we're looking for telltale signs like esophageal rings, linear furrows, maybe some white exudates or plaques.
And those visual cues are suggestive of EOE, but not definitive, right?
Right. We need that histological confirmation. We need to see those eosinophils under the microscope.
And how many eosinophils are we talking about to seal the deal on an EOE diagnosis?
The magic number is at least 15 eosinophils per high power field. And here's another crucial point. Those biopsies have to be taken from at least 6 different esophageal locations.
6 different locations. Why so many?
We have to make sure it's not just a localized thing. We need to see that eosinophilic infiltration throughout the esophagus.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's this combination of those endoscopic findings and then the histologic confirmation that gives us that definitive EOE diagnosis.
Exactly. And one more thing to keep in mind, we always have to rule out other conditions that can mimic EOE.
Like what?
Well, GERD is a big one. It can sometimes present with esophageal eosinophilia, but it usually responds to PPIs. We also need to rule out other causes of esophageal strictures, things like achalasia or even infections like candida esophagitis.
So it's about being thorough, considering all the possibilities before we land on that EOE diagnosis.
Precisely. We want to make sure we're treating the right condition and not missing something important.
Makes perfect sense. So we've diagnosed our patient with EOE. Now what? What are the treatment options and how do we go about managing this condition?
Well, the good news is we have a pretty well-established approach to managing EOE. It's what we call the 3D approach: diet, drugs, and dilation.
Okay, I like it. Nice and memorable. Let's break down each of those D's, starting with dietary therapy. What's the role of diet in managing EOE?
Well, the goal of dietary therapy is to eliminate those trigger foods that are driving the allergic inflammation.
Makes sense. But how do we go about identifying those triggers? It's not always obvious, is it?
No, it's not. And there are a few different approaches we can take. One is the 6-Food Elimination Diet, or SFAD for short.
SFE, I've heard of that. It's pretty restrictive, though, isn't it?
It is. You're basically eliminating the most common food allergens.
Yeah.
Dairy, wheat, eggs, soy, nuts, and seafood.
Wow, that's a lot to cut out. But I guess the idea is to see if symptoms improve when those foods are removed.
Exactly. It's not a forever diet, more of a diagnostic tool to help pinpoint those culprits. And if that doesn't work, we can try a more stepwise approach.
Stepwise meaning?
We systematically remove and then reintroduce suspected allergens one at a time to see if we can isolate those specific triggers.
So a bit more of a detective approach.
Yeah.
And what if those dietary strategies aren't enough? What about medications? What role do they play in managing EOE?
Medications are definitely a key part of the treatment plan, especially when dietary changes alone aren't cutting it. We mainly rely on 2 classes of drugs: proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, and topical corticosteroids.
Now, this might be a bit of a tricky concept for the SCE. Why use PPIs in a condition that's not primarily driven by excess acid?
That's a great question. Remember, PPIs have anti-inflammatory properties beyond their effects on acid production.
Ah, so it's not just about suppressing acid. It's about tackling that inflammation directly.
Precisely. And in EOE, we often use PPIs at higher doses than we would for typical GERD.
Okay, that makes sense. So PPIs are part of the equation. What about those topical corticosteroids?
They're often the preferred choice, especially when we see lots of eosinophils in the esophagus. They work by directly reducing that local inflammation.
And how are they administered?
We can use butazinide oral viscous slurry, which is swallowed and coats the esophageal lining. Or we can even use swallowed fluticasone, though that's technically off-label for EOE.
So we have a couple of different delivery options there, but I'm guessing those topical steroids aren't without their side effects, right?
They generally have a good safety profile because they're acting locally in the esophagus, but we always weigh the risks and benefits, especially for long-term use.
Of course. And what about that final D, dilation? When does that come into play in the EOE management?
Dilation is reserved for those cases where we're dealing with significant esophageal strictures. These are narrowings of the esophagus that can cause persistent difficulty swallowing.
And how does dilation work?
We use an endoscope to gently stretch those narrowed areas, basically widening the passageway so food can pass through more easily.
Sounds pretty straightforward, but I'm guessing it's not without its risks.
You're right. The main risk is perforation, which is basically a tear in the esophageal wall. That's why dilation needs to be done very carefully by an experienced endoscopist.
So it's a valuable tool in our arsenal, but one we use judiciously, weighing those potential risks and benefits.
Absolutely. It's not a first-line therapy, and it's always a decision made in consultation with the patient.
Okay, so we've got our 3 Ds of EOE management, diet, drugs, and dilation. We've addressed the initial treatment phase. What about monitoring? How do we know if our chosen approach is working, and what does long-term follow-up look like for EOE patients?
Well, the first step is to reassess the patient after we've initiated treatment.
And how long do we typically wait before that reassessment?
Usually about 8 to 12 weeks, we do a repeat endoscopy with biopsies to see how things are looking both visually and microscopically.
So we're checking for improvement in those endoscopic findings and also seeing if that eosinophil count has come down.
Exactly. And if things are looking good, we can start thinking about maintenance therapy.
Maintenance therapy meaning?
It depends on the individual patient. Some might be able to manage with just dietary modifications. Others might need to continue with medications long term.
And I'm guessing long-term follow-up is essential in EOE.
Absolutely. We want to make sure those symptoms stay under control and monitor for any signs of recurrence.
And how often do we typically see EOE patients for follow-up?
It varies, but generally we'd recommend checkups every 6 to 12 months. And if there's a history of strictures, we'll want to do surveillance endoscopies periodically to make sure those aren't coming back.
So it's this ongoing process of monitoring, adjusting treatment as needed, and being vigilant for any signs of trouble.
Exactly. EOE is a chronic condition, remember. It requires that long-term perspective and that close partnership between the patient and their doctor.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here, from the basic pathophysiology of EOE to those essential diagnostic criteria and the key elements of management.
We've laid a solid foundation for understanding this condition.
But as they say, there's always more to learn.
There always is, especially in a field as dynamic as gastroenterology.
Exactly. And I'm eager to hear your thoughts on some of the more advanced concepts related to EOE.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and we're just getting started.
Fantastic. We'll be right back after a quick break to explore those emerging frontiers in EOE treatment and tackle some thought-provoking questions that might pop up on the SCE. Stay tuned.
Sounds good. Now, let's say we have a patient who's really doing their best with those 3Ds, but their symptoms just aren't budging.
The dreaded refractory EOE. Tough cases. What do you do then?
Well, first we've got to figure out why those strategies aren't working. Is it the diet? Are they still being exposed to a trigger food they don't even realize?
So back to the drawing board on the diet front.
Right. Maybe we need to get even more restrictive with the elimination diet, or even consider an elemental diet, breaking things down to the bare essentials.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
What about the medications? Any adjustments there?
We could try bumping up the PPI dose or maybe switch to a different topical steroid.
And if those don't work?
Well, in severe cases, we might think about a short course of systemic steroids, but those come with their own set of risks.
Right. We always want to be mindful of those long-term side effects. Okay, so we've tweaked the diet, adjusted the meds. What if we're seeing complications like strictures that just keep coming back?
That's when we might need to consider endoscopic dilation again. Remember, it's a tool we use cautiously, but it can be really helpful in those situations.
Okay, so dilation is still on the table, but we're always weighing those risks and benefits.
Always. It's all about finding that right balance for each patient.
This is all good stuff, but I know our listeners who are prepping for the SCE need to be ready for anything. What about those really tough cases? The ones that just don't respond to any of the usual treatments?
You're talking about refractory EOE? And yeah, those can be real head scratchers. But the good news is there's hope.
Because of those biologics we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Biologics are changing the game for a lot of immune-mediated conditions, and EOE is no exception.
I know we touched on them briefly, but for those who might need a refresher, can you explain what makes biologics so special in the context of EoE?
Well, remember those immune pathways we talked about, the ones that are driving all that inflammation?
Yeah, those TH2 cells and all those cytokines they release.
Right. Biologics can actually target those specific pathways, like little guided missiles interrupting that whole inflammatory cascade.
So instead of just trying to suppress the immune system broadly, we're getting much more precise with our targeting.
Exactly. And that means fewer side effects and hopefully better outcomes for patients.
You mentioned dupilumab earlier, which blocks the IL-4, IL-13 pathway. Any other biologics on the horizon that our listeners should be aware of?
Another one to keep in mind is mepolizumab. It targets IL-5, which is a key player in the production and survival of eosinophils. So by blocking IL-5, we can actually reduce the number of those troublemakers circulating in the blood.
So we've got these new weapons in our arsenal, these targeted therapies that are really changing the landscape of EoE treatment.
It's an exciting time to be in the field, that's for sure.
Okay, so we've talked about the challenges of managing refractory EoE, and we've highlighted the promise of these new biologics. But before we move on, I want to touch on the prognosis for patients with EoE.
It's a question that comes up a lot, and it's important to be honest and realistic with patients. Meaning, EoE is a chronic condition, and it's likely something they'll need to manage for the rest of their lives. But with the right treatment and close follow-up, they can absolutely live full and active lives.
So it's about setting those realistic expectations and emphasizing the importance of that ongoing partnership between the patient and their healthcare team.
Absolutely. It's a team effort, and communication is key.
We talked earlier about the potential for strictures as a complication of EoE. Are there any other long-term consequences that our listeners should be aware of, especially those who are gearing up for the SCE?
One thing to consider, especially in kids, is the potential impact on nutrition. If EoE is left untreated or if it's not well controlled, it can lead to problems with weight gain and growth.
So that's something we really need to be monitoring, particularly in our pediatric patients.
Absolutely. And it highlights the importance of a multidisciplinary approach. We might need to bring in a dietitian, maybe even a psychologist, to address all the different aspects of this condition.
It's not just about treating the esophagus, it's about caring for the whole patient.
Exactly. That holistic approach is so important in EoE.
This has been an amazing discussion. We've covered so much ground, but I'm eager to hear your final thoughts on the future of EoE research and treatment. What are you most excited about? What should our listeners keep their eyes on as they move forward in their careers?
Oh, there's so much to be excited about. I think personalized medicine is going to be huge.
Personalized medicine, meaning?
Yeah, so imagine being able to look at a patient's genetic profile or their specific immune markers and say, okay, based on your unique makeup, this is the treatment that's most likely to work for you.
That's incredible. So we're talking about tailoring those 3Ds, the diet, drugs, and dilation, to each individual patient.
Precisely. No more trial and error, no more throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. We can be much more precise and targeted with our therapies.
That's a game changer for EoE care. What else is getting you excited in the world of EoE research?
Well, the microbiome is another hot area. We're learning more and more about how those trillions of bacteria in our gut influence our immune system, and it seems like they might play a role in EoE as well.
So could we potentially manipulate the microbiome to treat EoE? Are we talking probiotics, fecal transplants, that sort of thing?
It's definitely a possibility. Early studies suggest that altering the gut microbiome might actually dampen that inflammatory response in EoE.
Wow, that's fascinating. So much potential there. It seems like every day we're uncovering new layers of complexity when it comes to the gut and its impact on our overall health.
It's an incredibly exciting field, and there's still so much we don't know. But with all the research that's happening, I'm confident we'll have even more effective treatments for EoE in the not too distant future.
That's great news for both patients and clinicians alike. Well, I think we've covered just about everything our listeners need to know to tackle those EoE questions on the SCE.
I agree. They're armed with the knowledge, and hopefully they're feeling a lot more confident about approaching those challenging cases.
Exactly. Remember, the SCE is designed to test your clinical reasoning skills, your ability to apply that knowledge in real-world scenarios.
So don't just memorize facts. Think critically, visualize those concepts we've discussed, and approach each question systematically.
And most importantly, stay calm, stay focused. You've got this.
Absolutely. You've put in the hard work, you've absorbed all this information. Now go out there and crush that exam.
Well said. And that concludes our deep dive into the world of eosinophilic esophagitis.
It's been a pleasure joining you on this journey.
We're so glad you joined us, and we wish you the very best on your SCE exam. Thanks for listening.